From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Well, the release of the results of Monday's Iowa caucuses was delayed until Tuesday. As of this past weekend, most polling showed Bernie Sanders a strong front runner. But that apparently wasn't sitting well with much of the corporate media. RT's Caleb Maupin has more.
The Iowa caucuses are upon us. And Monday, as the first primary contest takes place, jaws are dropping because the front runner isn't one of these sexy centrists favored by the DNC, but an elderly socialist from Vermont who's technically not even a Democrat, but a registered independent.
Can't imagine any woman watching last night and saying, I believe Bernie. I think people believe Elizabeth.
Running Bernie Sanders against Trump would be an act of insanity.
So to have him just flat out say no, I think wasn't nearly enough to address that for the women watching.
Bernie can't win.
According to the New York Times, Bernie Sanders is surging ahead because he has an enthusiastic base of supporters who are attracted to his left of center agenda.
Mr. Sanders' endurance and his apparent rise in the earliest primary and caucus states reflects both the loyalty of his core supporters and their conviction that Mr. Sanders would bring the same fighting resilience to the general election. Even now, as Mr. Sanders takes a lead in the first two early states, his opponents have not delivered a sustained argument against his candidacy and remain reluctant to take him on.
Bernie Sanders describes himself as a democratic socialist, and socialism is supposed to be a dirty word in the United States, but not so much anymore. Polls show that younger people are not so hostile to the term and are far more critical of free market policies and austerity. CNN is certainly no fan of Bernie Sanders. A paid contributor is even happy to admit it.
I hope that my network's clear bias against Bernie Sanders will convince citizens of all ideologies that corporate media figures overwhelmingly forsake journalism in favor of blatant activism.
Oddly, President Trump has had mixed things to say about the frontrunner in the rival party.
I wish Bernie well. It'll be interesting to see how he does. I think what happened to Bernie maybe was not so nice. I think he was taken advantage of. He ran great 4 years ago, and he was not treated with respect by Clinton.
Those wounds from 2016 are certainly open and sore among Bernie's core supporters. Leaked emails revealed that the DNC was working overtime to deprive him of the nomination. It's not just those mainstream TV networks or the leaders of the Democratic Party. This former assistant director of the FBI actually admitted that for years, this federal agency actually worked to keep people like Bernie Sanders from taking office.
The electorate in some places is putting more and more progressives and self-described socialists in positions. One of the missions of the FBI in its counterintelligence efforts was to try and keep these people out of government.
He wasn't joking either. The FBI's COINTELPRO program worked to isolate left-wing groups and keep them from gaining any influence. One radical group called the Socialist Workers Party actually sued the FBI and spent a decade in court proving that their rights were violated. Court proceedings revealed that the FBI had planted fake news stories, infiltrated the organization, broken into offices, and even had members arrested on false charges, all in the hopes of weakening the socialists at the ballot box. Bernie Sanders was at one point a registered elector for the Socialist Workers Party. He campaigned for them amid the harassment and legal battles, so it's pretty safe to say the FBI has been on to him for some time. With so much working against him, Bernie Sanders seems to be pulling ahead, getting more donations than any other candidate. And his rallies are packed full of young people who are attracted to his message of canceling student debt and guaranteeing health care. With the 2020 primaries in full swing, many observers are asking themselves, can Bernie Sanders really pull this off? Caleb Maupin, RT, New York.
People living in the People's Republic of China have nothing to worry about financially in the event they contract the coronavirus. This was the Vice Minister of the National Health Commission, Li Bin, announcing a government program to cover the costs.
First, we've implemented policies to provide free treatment for those infected. Second, we will provide temporary subsidies to medical personnel. Situations where health workers get infected while on duty will be deemed as workplace injury and they will be entitled to relevant subsidies. Moreover, the Finance Ministry has allocated 1 billion yuan in support of Hubei Province. In addition, over 60 billion yuan will be allocated to support community-level medical efforts.
And although it might seem counterintuitive to people in the United States, where socialized health care is seen as an extravagance that the state cannot afford, the managing director of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, praised China's willingness to tackle this crisis with public funds.
We support China's efforts to respond by taking measures with all the strength of its health system, but also by the recent fiscal, monetary, and financial actions. We are confident in the resilience of China's economy.
UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson delivered a post-Brexit speech in London on Monday, announcing a tougher strategy with respect to customs regulations for EU goods imported to his country. He spoke ahead of trade talks between the parties, which are due to begin next month. The UK officially left the EU on January 31st and is now engaged in an 11-month transition period. This was UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Monday.
Thank you for coming to Greenwich. And I invite you, first of all, to do as I'm sure you've done before, to raise your eyes to the heavens, because the Vatican has Michelangelo, Greenwich has Thornhill, who spent 20 years flat on his back on top of scaffolding, and so rigid that his arm became permanently wonky. And he's left us this gorgeous and slightly bonkers symbolic scene that captures the spirit of the United Kingdom in the early 18th century. This painting above you was started in 1707, the very year when the Union of Scotland was agreed, and does it not speak of supreme national self-confidence? Look at these well-fed nymphs and cupids and what have you. They are not just celebrating the triumph of liberty and peace over tyranny, the official title of the scene. This is the settlement of a long and divisive political question about who gets to sit on the throne of England, and it is visibly resolved, as you can see, in favour of William and Mary, and the result is stability and certainty and optimism and an explosion of global trade propelled by new maritime technology. And above around us, you can see the anchors, cables, rudders, sails, oars, ensigns, powder barrels, sextants, the compasses, the grappling irons. In fact, the only important bit of kit that is missing is Harrison's sea clock, also exhibited close by here in Greenwich and also commissioned in the same era, that allowed every ship in the world to determine how far they were from this meridian. So this is it. This is the newly forged United Kingdom on the slipway. This is the moment when it all took off, and you know where this is going today. If we get it right, if we have the courage to follow the instincts and the instructions of the British people, this can be another such moment on the launching pad. Because once again, we have settled a long-running question of sovereign authority. We have ended a debate that has run for 3.5 years, some would say 47 years. I won't even mention the name of the controversy, except to say that it begins with B and it's receding in the past behind us. We have the opportunity. We have the newly recaptured powers. We know where we want to go. And that is out into the world. And today, in Geneva, our ambassador, Julian Braithwaite, moves seats in the World Trade Organization and takes back control of our tariff schedules, an event that itself deserves to be immortalized in oil. This country is leaving its chrysalis. We are re-emerging after decades of hibernation as a campaigner for global free trade. And frankly, it is not a moment too soon, because the argument for this fundamental liberty is now not being made. We in the global community are in danger of forgetting the key insight of those great Scottish thinkers, the invisible hand, of Adam Smith, and of course David Ricardo's more subtle but indispensable principle of comparative advantage, which teaches that if countries learn to specialize and exchange, then overall wealth will increase and productivity will increase, leading Cobden to conclude that free trade is God's diplomacy, the only certain way of uniting people in the bonds of peace. Since the more freely goods cross borders, the less likely it is that troops will ever cross borders. And since these notions were born here in this country, it has been free trade that has done more than any other single economic idea to raise billions out of poverty, and incredibly fast. In 1990, there were 37% of the world's population in absolute poverty. That is now down to less than 10%. And yet, my friends, I am here to warn you today that this beneficial magic is fading. Free trade is being choked. And that is no fault of the people. That's no fault of individual consumers. I'm afraid it is the politicians who are failing to lead. The mercantilists are everywhere. The protectionists are gaining ground. From Brussels to China to Washington, tariffs are being waved around like cudgels, even in debates on foreign policy, where frankly they have no place. And there is an ever-growing proliferation of non-tariff barriers. And the resulting tensions are letting the air out of the tires of the world economy. World trade volumes are lagging behind global growth. Trade used to grow at roughly double global GDP, 1987 to 2007. Now it barely keeps pace. And global growth is itself anemic. And the decline in global poverty that I referred to, that decline is itself now starting to slow. And in that context, when we're starting to hear some bizarre autarkic rhetoric, when barriers are going up, and when there is a risk that new diseases such as coronavirus will trigger a panic, and a desire for market segregation that go beyond what is medically rational to the point of doing real and unnecessary economic damage, then, at that moment, humanity needs some government somewhere that is willing at least to make the case powerfully for freedom of exchange. Some country ready to take off its Clark Kent spectacles and leap into the phone booth and emerge with its cloak flowing as the supercharged champion of the right of populations of the earth to buy and sell freely among each other. And here in Greenwich in the first week of February 2020, I can tell you, in all humility, that the UK is ready for that role. We're ready for the great multi-dimensional game of chess in which we engage in more than one negotiation at once. And we are limbering up to use nerves and muscles and instincts that this country has not had to use for half a century. Secretary of State Liz Truss tells me she has the teams in place. Is that right, Liz?
It is.
Yes. She has the lawyers, top dollar, I've no doubt, economists, trade policy experts. And if we don't have enough, and if they don't perform, believe me, we'll hire some more. We will reach out to the Commonwealth, which now has some of the fastest growing economies in the world. It was fantastic at the recent Africa Summit to see how many wanted to turn that great family of nations into a free trade zone, even if we have to begin with clumps and groups. We will take these ideas forward at Kigali in June. We will engage with Japan, and other Trans-Pacific Agreement countries, with old friends and partners, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, on whom we deliberately turned our backs in the early 1970s, we will get going with our friends in America. And I share the optimism of President Trump. And I say to all the naive and juvenile anti-Americans in this country, if there are any, there seem to be some, I say, grow up, get a grip. The US already buys 1/5 of everything we export. And yes, of course, there are going to be difficulties, and our shower trays still seem to fall foul of US rules, Liz. And if you want to sell insurance across America, Mr. Ambassador, you still have to deal with 50 separate regulators. And it is high time, I think we all agree, that they cut their punitive tariffs on Scotch whisky. And it goes without saying to all those conspiracy theorists who may still be in existence, all those believers in the Bermuda Triangle, or who think that Elvis is shortly to be found on Mars, it goes without saying that the NHS is not on the table. And we will not accept any diminution in food, hygiene, or animal welfare standards. But I must say to the America bashers in this country, if there are any, in doing free trade deals, we will be governed by science and not by mumbo jumbo. Because the potential is enormous. And of course, that brings me to the other area where the potential is perhaps even greater. We want a thriving trade and economic relationship with the EU. Our historic friends, partners, neighbours, and I shall today be tabling a parliamentary statement spelling out our objectives. And at the outset, I just want to say to our friends, I want to reassure you about one thing. I want to lay one myth to rest. We will not engage in some cutthroat race to the bottom. We are not leaving the EU to undermine European standards. We will not engage in any kind of dumping, whether commercial or social or environmental. And don't just listen to what I say or what we say. Look at what we do. And I say respectfully to our friends that in all those three crucial areas that I just mentioned, the anxiety should really be on our side of the channel, not yours. Look at state aid. France spends twice as much on state aid as the UK. Germany, 3 times as much. Who's using subsidies to undercut? Not the UK. In fact, the EU has enforced state aid rules against the UK only 4 times in the last 21 years, compared with 29 enforcement actions against France, 45 against Italy, and 67 against Germany. The same applies even more emphatically to social policy. And here again, I dispel the absurd caricature of Britain as a nation bent on the slash and burn of workers' rights and environmental protection, as if we are saved from Dickensian squalor only by enlightened EU regulation, as if it was only thanks to Brussels that we're not preparing to send children back up chimneys. In one field after another, Britain is far ahead. The EU waited until last year before introducing 2 weeks of paid paternity leave. We in the UK guaranteed that right nearly 2 decades ago. The EU gives employees the right to request flexible working only if they are parents or carers. The UK provides that right to every employee with more than 6 months' service, and they can make the request for any reason. The EU provides a minimum of 14 weeks paid maternity leave. Britain offers up to a year with 39 weeks paid and an option to convert this to shared parental leave. How about that? The UK has a higher minimum wage than all but three EU member states. In fact, six EU countries have no minimum wage at all. As for the environment, look at animal welfare. It's not just that we want to go further than the EU in banning live shipment of animals. There are ways in which we are already further ahead. The UK banned veal crates fully 16 years before the EU. We are protecting elephants by introducing one of the strictest ivory bans in the world. And the EU, meanwhile, is still in the consultation stage. And on the great environmental issue of our time, perhaps the greatest issue facing humanity, Britain was the first major economy in the world, let alone the EU, to place upon our own shoulders a legal obligation to be carbon neutral by 2050. That will put huge strains on our system. We know that, Saj. It will require thought and effort and change. But we know we can do it. We've cut carbon emissions by nearly twice the EU average since 1990. 42%, we've cut, while the GDP has grown by about 70%. But here is the question. Are we going to insist that the EU does everything that we do as the price of free trade? Are we? Of course not. Our legislation to ban single-use plastics goes further and faster than anything proposed by the EU. Does that mean we will refuse to accept a zero tariff, zero quota deal with the EU unless the EU agrees to match us every step of the way? Will we stop Italian cars or German wine? No stereotypes here. From entering this country tariff-free or quota-free, unless the EU matches our UK laws on plastic coffee stirrers or maternity leave, or unless they match our laws in any other field of policy that might conceivably affect the production of an Alfa Romeo or a bottle of Gewürztraminer. Will we accuse them of dumping? Of course not. Or wanting to dump? Of course not. So I hope our friends will understand that what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. There is no need for a free trade agreement to involve accepting EU rules on competition policy, subsidies, social protection, the environment, or anything similar. Any more than the EU should be obliged to accept UK rules. The UK will maintain the highest standards in these areas, better in many respects than those of the EU, without the compulsion of a treaty. And it is vital to say this now, clearly, because we have so often been told that we must choose between full access to the EU market, along with accepting its rules and courts, on the Norway model, or a free trade agreement, which opens up markets and avoids the full panoply of EU regulation, like the Canada deal. Well, folks, I hope you got the message by now. We've made a choice. We want a comprehensive free trade agreement similar to Canada's. But in the unlikely event that we do not succeed, then our trade will have to be based on our existing withdrawal agreement with the EU. And let's be clear, the choice is emphatically not deal or no deal. We have a deal. We've done it. And it did indeed turn out, as I correctly prophesied, to be oven ready. The question is whether we agree a trading relationship with the EU comparable to Canada's or more like Australia's. And I have no doubt that in either case, the UK will prosper mightily. And of course, our new relationship with our closest neighbours will range far beyond trade. We will seek a pragmatic agreement on security, on protecting our citizens without trespassing on the autonomy of our respective legal systems. I hope that we can reach an agreement on aviation, allowing cheap flights to continue. We are ready to consider an agreement on fisheries, but it must reflect the fact that the UK will be an independent coastal state at the end of this year, 2020, controlling our own waters, and under such an agreement, there will be annual negotiations with the EU using the latest scientific data, ensuring that British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats. And in this and in all these other areas, I see the need for warmth. And we'll get that. For warmth, we'll deliver that. For cooperation, for friendship, for exchange, for all the va-et-vient that has come to be so important for our academics, for our students, for our businesses. But I see no need to bind ourselves to an agreement with the EU. We will restore full sovereign control over our borders and immigration, competition, subsidy rules, procurement, data protection. And while we will always cooperate with our European friends in foreign and defence policy, whenever our interests converge, as they often, if not always, will, this will not, in my view, necessarily require any new treaty or new institutions, because we will not need them, for the simple reason that the UK is not a European power by treaty or by law, but by irrevocable facts of history and geography and language and culture and instinct and sentiment. And in setting train the biggest review of foreign and defence and security policies that since the Cold War, which is designed to seize the opportunities that lie ahead and make sure that we play our part in addressing the world's problems, I know that we will do it in common, in cooperation with our European friends. And I say to our European friends, many of whom I'm delighted to say, representatives of whom I'm delighted to say I see in this room, we are here as ever, as we have been for decades, for centuries, to support and to help, as we've done over the last 100 years or more. And the reason I stress this need for full legal autonomy, the reason we do not seek membership or part membership of the customs union or alignment of any kind, is at least partly that I want this country to be an independent actor and catalyst for free trade, as I have said, across the world. I was there when they negotiated the Uruguay round. I saw it completed in Geneva when they gaveled it out, and it was one of those events that people hardly reported, but it was a fantastically important event in the life of the world. And it was a critical moment, in my view, that helped to lead to almost two decades of global growth and confidence. And then in 2008, we saw the abject failure of the Doha round. And though there were many culprits, there can be no doubt that both the EU and the US bear a heavy share of the blame for their refusal to compromise on farm subsidies. And of course, while we were in, the voice of the UK, though important, was muffled. And as we come out, I don't wish to exaggerate our influence or our potential influence, but then nor would I minimize the eagerness of our friends around the world to hear once again our independent voice. in free trade negotiations.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.